Yeah, thanks a lot, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to visit the Fields Institute again. I was here 16 years ago, which was actually the year when the Fields Institute moved from Waterloo to Toronto, and we had a meeting on aperiodic tilings, organized by Robert Moody and Gigi Patera. And actually back then there was a little competition about the nicest tiling, and Franz Gehler won the competition, and the plan was to build it up there in the backyard, but that hasn't happened, unfortunately. It would have been nice to have the nice tiling up there. So, as Egon said, this is a little double feature, and it will be very smooth going, so we want to tell you a little bit about this field, which is, as you will see, quite different from what you do. So maybe my excuse is that tilings are rigid and they have symmetry. But let me start by telling you a little story. Now, what we see here is the diffraction image of something. And diffraction came up in one talk yesterday. So this is actually not X-ray diffraction, this is electron diffraction, but for the purpose of what I'm saying, it makes no difference. And this is not the original image seen by Schechtmann in 1982. I will come to Schechtmann in a second, but it's actually, so to say, a modern version of it. It's the diffraction image of some ternary alloy, and you see it has very nice and sharp reflexes, and it has tenfold symmetry. Well, it's a projection. Actually, if you would sort of say view the three-dimensional structure, it would have perfect icosahedral symmetry, and the reflexes are as sharp as those of the best of crystals, and the symmetry is as good as one of the best of crystals, but can't be a crystal, because as you all know, the crystallographic restriction forbids that. So when that was found in the early 1980s, it was a bit of a shock. Yeah, and actually, on the next image, I show you that these days you can grow the substances. Well, this is, I don't know what the unit is, but you see, it's a microscopic thing, and it grows. You can really grow the crystals, and here's a little model. It was discovered more or less at the same time. It's built from two rhombohedra, a thick and a flat one, and here is, so to say, the beginning of a tiling. Yeah, so it's just the decomposition of Kepler's tricontrahedron into smaller copies of these two guys, and maybe let them go around, and you can extend this to a tiling of three space built from these two gentlemen alone, and it has icosahedral symmetry. So it's not a periodic object. It can be described as a projection of something periodic in six space. I will explain a little later how that goes, and it would produce a diffraction image of this kind. So this is just the beginning of something that would model a structure that would produce such an image. Okay, when this was discovered, some people said weird things to Dan Schechtmann. Here is the gentleman. He got this year's Nobel Prize in Chemistry for his discovery. And maybe the rudest I found came from Linus Pauling, double Nobel Prize winner himself. And when he was confronted with what Schechtmann had found, he apparently said things like, Schechtmann is talking nonsense. There is no such thing as a quasi-crystal. There are only quasi-scientists. Okay, that's what he said. But, I mean, I just want to make this point, because that's why I think it's very good, also for the field of polytopes and tilings and so on, that finally it was acknowledged that here is a man who saw these things almost 30 years ago, realized there's something going on, and he actually went on to show it's not one of the weird things like twinning or whatever, it's a real object, a real phenomenon, and the crystallographers had to learn what was wrong in their assumption that you can only get images like this from what mathematicians would call a perfect crystal. Yeah? And actually the difference is that the reflexes here, they would actually be supported on a dense set of points. Except that. When the crystal, that would not be the case. It would be supported in a discrete, uniformly discrete set of points. Here it would be supported on a dense set of points, except that most reflexes are so small in intensity relative to the central one that with an apparatus of finite resolution, you would only see a discrete part of them, which explains this. And in mathematical terms, what you see here is just a measure that's locally finite. Yeah? So there is actually no contradiction. It's just a different variant of quasi-periodic functions. And everybody should have expected this, of course, which is easy to say with 30 years of hindsight. Yeah? But that's why, finally, I think he got the Nobel. Now, let me just use this opportunity to say a few very simple introductory things about these structures, and let me start with the notion of a periodic point set. And I will be talking about discrete point sets here, in fact even uniformly discrete point sets, in D space. And such a set we call periodic when t plus lambda equals lambda for some non-zero t. Yeah? And such a set is called crystallographic when the group of periods, actually the set of all t's that satisfies this always form a group, so the group of periods, pair of lambda, is a lattice. And by a lattice, I mean a co-compact discrete subgroup of Rd. Yeah? So something could be periodic without being crystallographic. Other terms in use would be fully periodic. Yeah? So if you don't like the word crystallographic, maybe say fully periodic. And here's the crystallographic restriction in general formulation that I alluded to before. If t, m is a Euclidean motion, so m is the orthogonal part, t is the translational part of it, that maps the crystallographic points at lambda onto itself, then the characteristic polynomial of m has integer coefficients only. That's fairly easy to prove. You basically have to do the transformations, and then you will see, after some fiddling around with the translational part, that m must map the basis vectors into integer linear combinations of them, and from that you see that m is actually similar to an integer matrix, so the characteristic polynomial has to have integer coefficients only. And if you work this out for dimensions 2 or 3, you get what you all know, namely rotational symmetries of something that we would call a perfect crystal can only have order 1, 2, 3, 4 or 6, but not 5 or whatever. Yeah? So this is, in a nutshell, was the problem for crystallographers. They just didn't think of the possibility that something that is not a crystal could still be so coherent as to produce these wonderful images, even though Harald Bohr, the younger brother of the famous physicist Niels, had developed almost periodic functions all along many, many years before. So that's a bit surprising. Now, for reasons that are maybe by now almost clear, we call a discrete point set non-crystallographic when the set of periods is not a lattice, and non-periodic when the period group is the trivial group. Yeah? So non-periodic is actually stronger than non-crystallographic. So here are two very dull examples, but I have reasons to use those. I mean, Z take away 0 is a non-crystallographic and a non-periodic set in one dimension, while this simple Cartesian product, Z take away 0 times Z, is non-crystallographic, but not non-periodic, because it still has a rank 1 set of periods. And now, I mean, these examples are kind of weird, in the sense that you would rightfully say, well, Z take away 0, I mean, it's just something periodic taking away one point. So we need a better notion to really understand what's going on. And that's actually the entry point of something that has been very successful during the last 10 years due to work by many people, including Boris Solomyak, Robert Moody, Jeff Ligarius. I could name quite a few that I'm sure are known to you. Namely, to see that there is a very natural connection between tilings or point sets and dynamical systems. So that's something that is not so much used in the framework of crystallography, because there it's kind of elementary what you get by that point of view, but it changes all the way when you go to non-periodic systems. I try to explain that a little. And for that, given a discrete point at lambda, I define what is called its hull. So the hull of a discrete point set is the following. So I take this point set and I take all translates of it. Yeah? Nothing dramatic happens. And then I take the closure of this set. And for taking the closure, I have to tell you the closure and what topology. And I take the... I'm about to explain that. So, if it's a discrete point set, and let's for a moment start with a point set that has finite local complexity, that is, up to translations, there are only finitely many patches of a given size. A patch is the intersection of a thing with a circle or ball. Yeah? So then I say, two discrete point sets are epsilon close to one another if possibly after a shift by something of at most length epsilon, the two sets agree on a ball of radius 1 over epsilon. So in other words, two point sets in this topology are close if after a tiny shift they exactly agree on a big ball. Yeah, that defines a topology. And that's a topology I would take the closure in here if it is finite local complexity. Well, if not, then I add what is called rubber. I do not only allow a global shift, but I actually allow each point to be moved by a tiny little bit. Yeah? So I put a little bit of... So I have the ideal point set, and each point, so to say, is actually stuck to its position by a tiny little rubber band, yeah, and I say two of these structures are close to one another if, so to say, if these rubber bands, which are allowed to have at most length epsilon, are enough to bring them onto one each other on a big ball of radius 1 over epsilon. Now, you had a question. Okay. So that's the slightly more general thing. We call it rubber topology, local rubber topology, because it's kind of it's very intuitive. Yeah. Now, these are all examples of what are called Fell topologies in topology, and you can even go to a more general frame using measures, and then these are all special cases of what is called the vague topology in the theory of Radon measures. But that's actually not important. What is important here is that under very mild assumptions, FLC would be enough, yeah, that this thing that comes out here is actually compact. It's a compact space in this topology. So out of my original set lambda, I have defined something which is called the hull, that is a compact set. Now, let's do this for the case that lambda is a crystallographic point set, just the crossing points of the square lattice, yeah? Just the square lattice points. Well, what would this be? It would just be the torus. Because you can shift it around, but if you sort of say shift it by a period, it's the same thing again. And taking the closure actually doesn't add anything to the picture. It's just this space would topologically be the same as the torus, the d-dimensional torus, if you do it for a d-dimensional lattice. However, if you do this for something like a Penrose tiling, or for the three-dimensional tiling that comes out of the little toy that's going around, something quite interesting happens. Yeah, you have this object, you have all the translates of the object, so that's one translation orbit, and then you take the closure, and even though the end result is compact, what's in it is has uncountably many translation orbits, so something really interesting happens in taking the closure. Yeah? So this is a non-trivial operation as soon as the point set here is non-crystallographic. Yeah? And that's exactly the point where a new insight comes from. Okay. Now, this is the point where we can sort of say strengthen the notation a little bit. And the suggestion is to use the following. A discrete point set is called aperiodic, which is supposed to mean a lot more than non-periodic, if the hull defined by this object contains only non-periodic elements. Now let's go back to this dull example. What's the hull of Z take away zero? Okay, that's Z take away zero. The translation of that is Z taking away one point somewhere. Yeah, they're all in there. But you can move this missing point behind the moon. So on the limit in this local topology, the hull defined by this guy certainly contains also Z. That's the limit. You've taken this missing point, you've shifted it away. In the local topology, yeah, on larger and larger balls, it looks just like Z. So the limit is in it. So this is a simple example that's non-periodic, but not aperiodic. So aperiodic is a much stronger notion. Okay? Yeah. So let me show you a simple aperiodic example. Two ways to construct it. One is by what is called the silver mean substitution. That's really this rule on an alphabet with letters A and B, and you keep on applying it and you produce a two-sided infinite word, and then you replace the letter A by an interval of length 1 plus root 2 and the letter B by interval of length 1, or which turns out to be a recipe for obtaining the same set. You use a two-dimensional lattice, the one that I've shown here. It's not the square lattice, it's actually the Minkowski embedding of this ring of integers in the quadratic field over root 2. And you say, okay, I take all points on this line that have the property that they are projections of these lattice points. Or in other words, I take all points of Z adjoined root 2 such that the algebraic conjugate is in this strip. That's the same thing. Yeah? So then you get all these points here. And that's a simple recipe to obtain a non-periodic sequence. It can't be periodic because this is the only lattice point that lies in this direction by construction. But it's also aperiodic in the stronger sense. I mean, that needs some proof, but it actually is. It's amazing, but it is. Yeah? And that's actually easier to prove after you've shown that this construction turned into a point that is the same as this construction. That again needs some proof, but there are well-established techniques by now to do that. So that's really something that you can, if you want, you can do in an introductory linear algebra course, or at least in algebra 1 if you insist on sort of say doing this algebraic conjugation type stuff. Yeah, and this is really the one-dimensional toy model for how to construct a mathematical quasi-crystal that underlies these construction rules. Okay, in general, what's going on here? So we have d-dimensional Euclidean space. That's the space where, in the end, we want to have our tiling, our point set. And going between point sets and tilings is more or less using the Delaunay complex to turn a point set into a tiling and maybe vice versa. Okay? But then there is some higher dimensional superspace, and in the superspace there is, I've written it down for the Euclidean situation, so you have another copy of Euclidean space Rm, even though this, in more generality, can be any locally compact abelian group, and that's actually a degree of freedom that you need in general, yeah? But for now it's good enough, think Euclidean. And within this bigger space there is a lattice, a co-compact discrete subgroup, such that its projection in this direction is 1-to-1, so that's kind of some irrationality condition. And the projection into this internal space, as it's called, is dense. That's kind of a condition to avoid pathological non-uniquenesses. Yeah? And this is a cut and project scheme, and because of this one-to-one mapping from here to physical space, or in direct space, there's a mapping called the star map from here to here. Now, in the previous example, that mapping was just algebraic conjugation. Yeah, that was the mapping. But this is formulated in more general terms, so you don't have to have an algebraic number field to do it, even though the most interesting examples can always be constructed that way. Okay, and now what we do is we take points out of the projection of the lattice, this in general will also be a dense point set, with the additional constraint that its star map is inside some nice set. And this set W for window, yeah, is typically a compact set, that's the closure of its interior, and yeah, basically that's the requirement. And typically you also want that it has boundary of measure zero. But in general there are examples where this is not the case, but this is, so to say, the standard case. And now, in this setting of a model set, there is a fundamental theorem, I'm not going to say anything more detailed about it, that tells you that such a set produces a diffraction image as the one I've shown at the beginning, which means that the diffraction image is a pure point measure, it's a sum over a countable set of points, and there is a point mass at that point with an intensity that can explicitly be given by the Fourier transform of this window. Yeah? So this is a formidable theorem. Yeah? It's, if you want, it's a generalization of the Poisson summation formula to this more general setting. And that it actually is to be seen as a generalization of the Poisson summation formula is an insight that Jeff Ligarius had very early on and was always saying there must be a way to see this as a generalization of the Poisson summation formula. And that's what it is. Very quickly, in another example, a planar set. Here we can start from the integers of the eighth root of unity. So that's the integer linear combinations of these four vectors. And the star map is given by the Galois conjugation mapping the primitive root of unity to its third power. So that turns this set of vectors into these red ones. This is a construction that you know by heart, I'm sure, because you know everything about polytopes. And the constructions now take all cyclotomic integers in this ring with the constraint that its algebraic conjugate is inside a window which we take as a regular octagon with side length 1, and then you get this. Yeah, so this blue ones are the points in direct space, and the red ones are the points in internal space, yeah, and yeah, these are all inside this window, and this is what you get. And if you then line up every pair of points by a line that have distance 1, you actually get a tiling, and this is the eightfold symmetric relative of the famous Penrose tiling. Yeah, it's slightly simpler to describe in this cut of project formalism, that's why we use it, but there's a similar mechanism to do the Penrose tiling. Yes, that is a very good question. Thanks for that. The lattice here is the diagonal embedding of this by Minkowski lattice, and that is up to rotation equivalent to just the four-dimensional integer lattice. Yeah? So it's four-dimensional. And here's the corresponding diffraction image calculated exactly by the formula I showed you. So there's no numerical trickery involved here. This is just an exact calculation. Yeah? Of course, not every peak is shown because most of them are below any positive threshold, yeah? That's nice and clean, eightfold symmetric thing. So now I better go on. This is the Penrose tiling, and this is according to our terminology in aperiodic tiling. If you observe these little arrows here, and you put the two rhombi together in a way that you never violate the directions of them, then you can prove that you can actually fill the plane with it, but only non-periodically, and the corresponding hull only contains tilings that satisfy this local rule everywhere. So it's an aperiodic tiling in that sense. And most of the tilings known, very few exceptions, and practically all in the plane, actually do have an underlying inflation structure. So the mechanism behind this is that you can, so to say, blow it up and subdivide in smaller copies so that you end up with the same kind of thing. And the multiplier is an irrational number, and that's not compatible with something periodic. Or if it's periodic, then you still get a limit periodic structure. Ooh, we'll show an example a little later. The only example in the plane that I know is the Carey-Coolidge prototype set, where you put together all these squares so that on all edges the symbols match, and that also produces something aperiodic, and that's arithmetic in nature. It's completely different. But it's very rare. Otherwise, question is, and now I'm sort of say coming to turn over to Uwe's part, is there a single shape that tiles space without gaps or overlaps but does not admit any periodic tiling? Well, that's of course one of the questions that have been posed very early on. And in free space there is the Schmidt-Conway-Danzer-Einstein. It's a double roof prism where sort of say the roof directions are at an incommensurate angle, and you can sort of say put them together to form still periodic, even crystallographic layers, planar crystallographic layers, but the next layer is rotated by something that can still have a period, but you get a screw axis that in the end destroys any periodicity. So it's aperiodic in that sense, but not strongly aperiodic. I didn't say that earlier on, because the symmetry group that remains is still infinite, because you still have a screw axis. Yeah? And in the plane, until recently, this was the best we had, so up to rotations, just these two prototypes. If you put those together without violating the edge matching rules, it can only fill tile the plane non-periodically. And is there a single one? Well, we don't know. So far, the best was the 1 plus epsilon square tiling due to Roger Penrose, which he introduced 16 years ago on that workshop I mentioned. And that's a good point to hand over to Uwe. Thanks for your attention. You'll hear that story now. Yes, it's. I only briefly said it. Consists of two parts, the integer lattice itself and the integer lattice taking away one point somewhere. That's the whole. And this is clearly a limit point of suitable translations of those. But if you start from this, you will never recover any of those. So in other words, this is a closed subset. But this is not closed and has this as a limit.
You said that in the plane there are essentially two ways that have been used to construct a periodic tiling. One is by inflation and the other one was the arithmetic version. And you said before that with this procedure of going to a higher dimension and selecting type, you can, the one side you see in the compact thing that you need to see that, and in the other side you see a set of points in the other space where by some rules you get the position. Isn't that a third way of getting?
Yes, that is true. I was a bit short at that point. Of course, you can use the projection method to also produce aperiodic tilings. However, in general, you do not have local rules that on their own would produce the same thing. Yeah, so for the Penrose tiling, you have two ways to do it. You can get it down from projection, then you don't see any arrows on the edges. Yeah, and it would be aperiodic as a result of taking this incommensurate direction. Yeah, but it wouldn't give you a clue, which is really a subtle topological question, whether you can impose local rules that, given the prototypes that you have, would force it. And when I said only two mechanisms are known, I was a bit short, that, sorry for that. I meant that if you start from a finite set of prototypes, yeah, and you give some rule how to put them together, local rule, yeah, There are only two underlying mechanisms known how to enforce non-periodicity. Yeah?
Welche Seite vermutlich?
Ja. Den am besten irgendwo festklipsen, damit
man es nicht runterfegt.
Ja, genau.
Ist das schon an?
Ja.
Same title. Same title, part two. I'm actually from that place, Milton Keynes, that was mentioned a few times already, which is a place near Titchley Hall, I learned. So if you're coming to that workshop, you may come and have a look at the Open University that's there, which is an interesting place because we're actually the biggest university in the UK, although all our students are kind of virtual because we teach at a distance. So quite an interesting place. What I want to talk about after Michael has given quite a lot of general definitions and a few examples is mainly what was mentioned here just a minute ago, is the recent development of an improvement on this question or in this situation. So I'll show you a picture of what this tiling is with this strange funny name, and I will show you what we know or do not know about a monotile. So it's a bit of a story again. Actually, this whole thing happened when we learned about it the first time when Michael and I were spending some time down in Tasmania, in Australia, and we got an email from Joshua Sokola saying that he had written this preprint, and he sent that preprint along, and the co-author was a Joanne Taylor. And we thought, who is that? We didn't quite know. It's not Jean Taylor, who has written a paper about what kind of matter diffracts. It's Joanne Taylor. And we looked at the address, and we found out actually she is from Burnie, Tasmania, which is you can't really see. This little bit here is Tasmania. We were down there in Hobart, and Burnie is at the top here. So we decided within a few days we should travel to Burnie and have a chat with that lady. And that turned out to be very interesting because she actually is she has been working on tilings for the last 15 years or so, but she's not really a professional mathematician. She did start to do a degree, I think, as something which is kind of an Australian equivalent of the Open University, but found it too boring, but had discovered a paper about Penrose tilings and decided that this is what she really was going to learn about and work on. And so she's been working essentially on her own, but knowing and using much of the existing literature in the field, so on tiling problems. And I'll just show you, before I show you that, I should say that This paper was actually based on her manuscript, so she really discovered that hexagonal tile I will be talking about first. And the original manuscript, which has not been published, is actually also available on the Bielefeld preprint server. And it does. There are some slight differences between the definitions here and there, but they are not substantial. Okay. I just wanted to show you a few pictures of the type of things she has been doing. So in her room, she had quite a lot of nice illustrations of tilings, and also this one, which is related to the monotile. This is also an hexagonal structure with the coloring of the system. Okay, so before I come to the hexagonal monotile, I'll introduce a couple of other tilings which are kind of similar in some sense, just to give you some bit of perspective. This one is the Robinson's tiling, which is a tiling of squares with these labels and these labeled lines. And the way this is to be read is the same as the arrows in the Penrose tiling. So you're allowed to put tiles together only if the arrows match in color and direction. Okay. So this is a patch of a possible tiling. You can see that these arrows match. And if you look at this closely, you'll find that you're essentially forced to use this blue tile on a sublattice, on a periodic sublattice like this, and put the yellow tiles in between. And you're also forced to produce closed loops of the red arrows like this. So you're going around like this. And in the center of these closed loops, you'll find a corner of another closed loop of a different scale. Okay? And this kind of construction goes on. So this is my original patch. So here are the original red loops. Then there are red loops which I've colored kind of yellowish at the next scale, and you find them all over the place again. And in the center of each, there is a corner of a loop of the next size, which is green here. In the center of that, there is a corner of a loop of this blue loop. And in the center of that, there is a corner of a purple loop, and that never stops. Yeah. So the way this fits together forces you to have these loops, the hierarchy of these loops. And this shows you that this cannot be a periodic structure, because there's no translation that can move an arbitrary large loop onto another arbitrary large loop. Yeah. So so it has a kind of a limit periodic structure because you have like factors of two built in here. So this is Robinson's tiling. And I should say that Michael mentioned substitution and inflation, and I'm going to talk about that a bit now. Just recently, an inflation has been discovered for this tiling as well, so it can also be described by this blowing up dissection type structure, or at least part of these tiles can be. So I'm closing in on the hexagonal tiling. So one that has been around for a long time, and this is in Grünbaum and Shepard's book, is the half-hex tiling. It's a very simple inflation rule. So you have just one tile, which is half a hexagon, half a regular hexagon. And it's the inflation consists of a scaling by a factor of two. So this is all lengths are scaled by two. And then you dissect the half hexagon into four copies of itself. Okay. And obviously you can iterate that. It's a bit like the A goes to ABA, B goes to A type structure. You just keep doing it all over again. And if you do it, you get actually an aperiodic tiling. And the way to see that, or one way to see that, is if I slightly change this and decorate it a bit, it becomes maybe a bit more interesting. So I put some red lines in here, and there the red line decoration is kind of moved on to the inflated copy like this. And if I then inflate this tiling, so this is what a patch looks like, and I put the red lines in, and I take away the points, you see the red lines better. You find a hierarchical structure which is a bit reminiscent of the one that I showed in the Robinson tiling. The difference is now I have triangles rather than squares, but I have these little triangles which live on a periodic. I mean, maybe if I go back, you can see that they live on this hexagonal structure, so they live on a periodic subset. Then I have the next size triangles, which live on another periodic hexagonal structure, actually, you can see. And then you have the next size of triangles, again, living on bigger hexagons, and that keeps going on. And so you see that this has to be another non-periodic structure. Okay. So, well, is that something like that? Is that a monotile? Well, not quite, because if you just take this hexagon with these markings and you demand that the markings have to fit together, you can still actually make periodic tilings for that. And here is an example. So it looks a bit like before, but it kind of stops at the second level of my triangles. So I have to do something more to kind of force the hierarchy to continue. Okay? Yeah, you can see you put three together, and this is kind of the basic motif, and you can just keep repeating that. And it's a valid tiling fulfilling these matching rules. Okay. So the last tiling I want to show before I come to the John Taylor tiling is that 1 plus epsilon square tiling that Penrose came up with in the attempt to create a tiling with a single monotile. And the reason that this name was chosen is that it consists of three tiles. So it's a one tile, an epsilon, and epsilon square tile. The one tile is a hexagon, is this red one, with some, well, instead of arrows here, he used little bumps. And so it's a bit like, it's really like a puzzle, in a sense. The epsilon part is the blue one here, and the epsilon square part is the yellow one here. And the reason for this name is that the sizes don't really matter. So you could make this blue tile arbitrarily thin, in principle, and you can make this tile arbitrarily small. Essentially, it's just a marking at the vertex. Yeah? So you, and these three tilings encode the local rules, and they define an aperiodic tiling in the sense that if you fill the plane without violating the rules anywhere, then the tiling has to be non-periodic. There's no way to make a periodic tiling with these three parts. So you could replace this by a marking in the corner. You can replace it by something thin, but you cannot actually get rid of it completely. And the reason is that if you look at this blue tile, you see that these edges have a different direction. So there's actually some information that is transmitted from this end to this end. Yeah? So you cannot completely replace it by a marking on the edge. So this is kind of as close as he got to having a single tile. There's one tile, but there are little kind of key tiles that have to be added. And his paper that is followed the talk at the Fields Institute 16 years ago does actually prove apodicity, and it proves it by giving an inflation rule for this tiling, which is quite complicated actually. Okay, so here we are. So this is the monotile, and these are figures taken from the paper by Sokolow and Taylor, which actually, well, not quite sure is published or not. It's available already, but formally, I think the journal issue is due in November, but I think it's already there on the website. It's Journal of Combinatorial Theory RA. So this is the hexagon with markings. There are two versions of it, but these are the same. The hexagon actually occurs in two orientations. It's maybe a bit easier to see it with this marking where you have like little flecks here. And so this is the reflected copy where you can see the flecks in the top are reflected and everything else stays the same. This is the same, but the orientation of the flecks has been encoded by colors, which is slightly less obvious in terms of how so you have to combine the reflection with a change of colors in a way. And here the reflected tiles have been colored gray to show the difference. So you have these tiles, and the rules are you can put them together such that the black lines match. Okay, and there is a rule on the colors, but the rule actually is not one that refers to neighboring tiles, but one to refers to like next neighboring tiles. So the rule is the one that's denoted by these arrows here. If you think of the flags, it means that the flag at this end of an edge and the flag at this end of an edge, they have to point in the same direction. Okay? Or in terms of colors, that means that the color here has to be opposite the color at this end. Yeah? So, in a way, so this is a local rule, because it's a short, I mean, it's only a short distance, yeah? It's what we would call a local rule. This local rule actually, as you can show, and I will kind of go through the argument rather quickly, I think, because there's not much time, to show you why this actually defines a non-periodic tiling. This local rule enforces non-periodicity. However, it is maybe, well, it depends what you mean by a monotile. It is maybe not quite what most people were after, because you can't actually encode this local rule by marking on one tile that, or by kind of like a puzzle type thing, by something that only kind of by shape alone, let's say it that way. You can't encode it by shape of a tile alone, yeah? Unless you allow for tiles that are not connected. So you can do it if you allow for a single tile that are non-connected. So this is just a cartoon of one possible way you could do it. So this is all the same tile, but the different copies of it have been colored differently, so you can find where each bit of the tile ended up. So you can, if you allow for non-connected tiles, then you can do it by one shape. But as long as you want one connected tile, then the rule extends to the next nearest neighbor, if you wish. Okay, so how can one see that this is non-periodic? And again, actually the paper gives two proofs. One is the one that Joe and Taylor came up originally, which is based on inflation, which I'll only mention at the end. And the first one is kind of a direct argument, which is a bit like what I've been showing you with the Robinson tiling. So I'll try to explain that in a few minutes. So if you start putting these things together, such that these black lines match, you will find that you are forced to have somewhere a little loop like this. Because, well, if you put two together like this, then you have to put one here like this in the first place already. So there's no choice. If you start putting things together like this, so you have a long one here, you find you have to put a long one here as well, and then you have to have a little loop right there. So as soon as you have that, you can see that, well, if you take any of these combinations that make a little loop, you have to have another little loop at the opposite side, okay? And, well, that, of course, means that once I have the loop here, I have another loop at the opposite side, and so on, opposite side here, for instance, and that travels throughout the tiling, and you're forced to have this kind of periodic substructure in your tiling. There's absolutely no way you can avoid it. Yeah? The only way you can fit these things together is you start with this kind of backbone structure. And this structure already fixes the kind of two-colored the single-color diameters. If I go back just to show you, these in terms of colors, there are three diameters here. Two have a single color, and there is one diameter that changes color, okay? So the two diameters that have a single color, that are, they are already fixed by this arrangement. What's missing here is the position of the long black line, which could be either up there or lower, and related to that, the color along that direction, okay? So the procedure now goes on like this. Yeah, well, you have these holes, and you have a choice what to put there. So put something in one hole. Say you put something like this in one hole. Then this has these little bits of the small triangles here. They could be in either direction, but they have to be somewhere. As soon as you have those here, you'll find you have to have the long edges like this to make it match. And then if you look at this dotted hexagon, you get a structure that looks exactly like what I had before, just on a bigger scale. Yeah? I have this bigger thing. It has these now larger looking notches here. But with the same argument, once I have chosen this here, I have to close that up somewhere. And so I get another, at the next layer, I get a structure, a periodic substructure made of these triangles of the next size. So, and then, so you can go on doing that, and it repeats with the same type of argument. So this kind of shows this schematically. You start with the gray ones, which are the first backbone I had, which has all these little loops. Then you place one, which color is it here, one green one, and that makes you the triangles of the next size, and you're forced to fill all these other green ones here. And then then there are still holes left, so you have another choice. You place one on one of these blue ones. That then defines this triangle, and you are forced to fill the blue ones in to fit with that. And then the next level of the hierarchy, you have another set of holes. You fill, say you put that one here, and then that forces these ones. And that continues like that. So you're forced at each stage, you're forced to a larger hierarchy. And that fixes actually also these colors, which is shown schematically here. Once you have these one color diameters we had fixed already in the first stage, and then once you put the triangles on the next level, you'll see that your matching rule, your local rule saying that this has to be opposite color from that, fixes the color in this triangle. So kind of in the second step you fix the colors for the first step, and in the first step you fix the colors for the second step. So it kind of goes on hierarchically like that. And you end up with something like this. Once you've filled all the holes, you can do it in a way that you kind of is essentially, well, you're kept with a single hole in the middle, and then you have something like six choices to put something in here in which orientation you want. And the difference is that the long line of the infinite triangle, if you wish, either goes like this, or it goes in one of the other directions, goes like that or like that. So you have a choice there in the end. So it's one argument why you can see that it can't be a periodic structure. Okay. And the other method uses the inflation, there's not enough time to talk through it really, but this is a general method that, as far as I know, only Franz Scheler in 1993 really wrote down, although I think it is implicit, certainly in Grünbaum and Shepard's book it's used implicitly. And it's a method to show that these local rules enforce non-periodicity, and the method uses an inflation structure, so it works for all these structures, but it doesn't work for the Carey-Coolidge one, which doesn't have an inflation structure, the one that Michael mentioned. And the requirements are there. You have to have an inflation rule that respects matching rules. So if you blow up your structure and dissect, the dissected tiles have to obey the local rules. And if you have any admitted tiling, so you start from anything that satisfies your local rules, then you can actually identify the super tiles, so the images of this inflation rule, in this tiling from the tiles and its neighbors. And these super tiles have to inherit markings that enforce equivalent matching rules. This was what I mentioned with this dotted hexagon, which looks essentially the same. So if at the next hierarchy level you have the same matching rules, then this is sufficient to show that the tiling is non-periodic. Okay, and I just finish by showing a couple of pages of the proof that is actually in that manuscript that you can find on the Bielefeld server, so where all the pictures are hand-drawn. And so you see this is the inflation rule that's behind the single hexagon tiling. It's actually quite complicated. It's 14 different tiles plus the mirror images of these. So it's really 28 different tiles. And they're labeled here A, B, C, D, whatever. But you can see that they're all of the type of the half hex rule, except that you have these markings which are compatible at the next level. So you have the markings at the small half hexes, there are these little black lines, and the green lines are the markings that are inherited by the super tiles. And the way the monotile was drawn from this tiling is actually quite complicated. So you see there, so this is kind of a patch that consists of lots of these. These are kind of the basic hexagons, which are two half hexagons. And the monotile actually comes about as the decoration of this big hexagon from this structure. So it's kind of actually a few hierarchies up in a way. But of course, since it's as similar, it doesn't really matter. You could start at a but this is the way it was described. And just a couple of pictures how the tiling looks like. So this is John Taylor's inflation rule, just encoded with kind of colored tiles to make it a little bit more visible. And this is the kind of structure you get. And I guess you can see the kind of limit periodic structure. You can see all these triangles as well. And you can see also the periodic substructures here. So these pale blue tile is one that... that you find on a periodic substructure, and then you find larger periodic substructures with other colored tiles in it. So it looks quite nice, really. So, yes, I should. Yeah, 1 minute maybe. Finally, it looks quite similar to Penrose's 1 plus epsilon and plus epsilon squared tiling, because if you remember what I said, that blue tile I had, this edge-type key tile for the Penrose tiling, it transmits information along an edge. And essentially, what the local rule here does of saying that these flags have to point in the same direction of two tiles that are separated by one edge, transmits information along an edge. So it is very similar. Yeah? And there was a question whether it's actually the same tiling in the sense that you can find a rule to go from one to the other, and there's also a rule to go the other way back. And it turns out there is a rule in one direction. So from Penrose's tiling, which is in the back here, you can give a rule that gives you a valid Taylor tiling, which is kind of shown here. So each hexagon is replaced by one of these Taylor hexagons, and each of these corner key tiles is replaced by a hexagon, and the blue tiles actually are replaced by nothing. And that gives you a rule that maps a valid Penrose 1 plus epsilon plus epsilon square tiling onto a valid Taylor tiling. If you want to go the other way, there's actually a 3-to-1 ambiguity, because you can essentially choose one of three sublattices to start from. So it is not equivalent in that respect. It's kind of, it's closely related, but it's not the same. It's not the same structure. And yeah, that was it. So I just finished with giving you a couple of references. And since somebody was said they were bold announcing a book, so we'll do the same. We've been writing on that. Actually, was what we were doing in Tasmania, because it's one of the few places you can find peace and quiet these days, from university administration and other people. So we were trying to write in our book, and it's still not quite finished, but we're hoping that it will come out next year, which gives kind of a general background and a lot of examples and a lot of pictures on this. And here are two papers by Sokola and Taylor. This is the one that's been published or just appearing, and there's another one that at the moment is only available as a preprint, which gives kind of like an interpretation in terms of a kind of thickened monotile, which is three-dimensional and you can put together in some way and things like that. And this is the reference of the original paper with the handwritten with the hand-drawn figures, which you can find on the Bielefeld server. Okay, thank you very much. That is much more restricted. This counting thing is a difficult one, because there are many different ways of counting. I mean, for instance, even for the Penrose tiling, Michael said there are two tiles, but it depends how you count. I mean, some people prefer to count by translations. In that case, of course, all of these tiles occur in like 5 or 10 orientations. So then you have 20 tiles. So it is a bit of a question of definition here. Yeah. It would be nice to have one tile which But as I say, yeah, we're far away. Of course, the trick of using a thickened tile in three dimension gets rid of that problem, because in three dimension you can turn it over and get the reflected copy, but in two dimensions you can't. Yeah, I guess it's to be honest, most people in the community probably felt that it's quite unlikely that there is a single tile in two dimensions. But in a way, this result maybe has kind of changed that somewhat. People may be looking more for that. And of course, like, you can do all kinds of things. You could have tiles with fractal boundaries and all that. I mean, there's a lot of freedom, and people have I know that some, I've forgotten who that was, there's certainly a group that has done some computer searches of gluing hexagons together in some funny shape and finding shapes that can tile the plane non-periodically up to, I think the biggest one they found, I think, had had then a unit cell where you had to put like 20 or 30 of these things together, but then it did repeat, so it's very hard to find that. But there's no proof it doesn't exist, even for a single tile without reflection. So. But in two dimensions, it's an open question. You mean it doesn't? Well, it doesn't. There's no. Yeah. Well. Like a three-dimensional monotile, which leaves only a finite group. I don't know. Do you know one? I don't think there's one. I mean, the Schmidt convergence, it still has the screw axis thing, and no, I'm not aware of one that doesn't have that property. So, but again, there's certainly no proof that it doesn't exist. It's just maybe something that may be hard to find.
Maybe one comment. I said earlier on that in general kind of project mechanism might lead to local contact between the group. So actually, the trailer type is nothing. That actually is a kind of project step. In the general space, it's just two copies of the two axes. So you can now also understand the projection type, just more modular.
Yes, that's where the hierarchy with these factors of two comes from. Yeah. Okay.
So, advance back.
Advance back. Laser pointer.
Advance and back. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. First, I would to thank the organizers for inviting me. I shall present you symmetry measures. What is the difference between symmetry and symmetry measures? There is or there is not symmetry. Symmetry measure means, do we deviate much from symmetry? People began to work on this topic at the end of the 19th century. Many methods were developed from several fields, chemistry, physics, computer sciences, statistics, and so on. The problem is that most of these methods apply in a very specific context. It is hard to have a general theory of that and to have a measure which applies in many contexts. So, to define a symmetry measure, we first have to exhibit a definition of symmetry. Of course, you all know what is symmetry. It is a bit funny if you look to a definition of symmetry which works both for the geometric case, for matrices, for functions, for distributions, for graphs and so on, it is hard to find that in the literature. So I have produced one, but probably it was published somewhere. No problem. So here is a definition of symmetry. Note that the group structure, which is imposed a priori, it is not needed to impose it a priori. It can be deduced, but it is a detail. So this is a very basic. Now, symmetry measure. We need to define a distance between objects. An object will be symmetric if and only if it exists a transformation, not the trivial one, of course, such that the distance between the object and its transformed image is null, obvious. So, to define a symmetry measure, the idea is to say we need to find the lower bound of the distance of the image and the object for all transformations except the identity one. Of course, when the object is symmetric, we get that this quantity is null. We call that a symmetry measure. We will see that this definition sometimes gives rise to many problems. But the idea is when this quantity is small, we are close to symmetry. But now, what means small? We have to compare to something. Other problem. When the symmetry measure is small, we would like to demonstrate that the object is symmetric indeed. In general, we cannot do that. But in a number of cases, we can. For example, when the set of transformations is finite. So, first attempt to define a symmetry measure. We have endpoints in the d-dimensional Euclidean space. We assume for clarity that this space is this set is centered. The center of mass is at the origin, no problem. These are the notations. This is, in fact, the covariance matrix, which I call the inertia matrix. The difference between the inertia matrix and the covariance matrix is just the factor head. So, in fact, it is the same thing. We need that the inertia, here, is not null, of course. And we define the direct symmetry index as shown here. DSI. You can recognize that the trace of x minus y transpose multiplied by x minus y divided by n, it is a known distance. I think it's originated from the Fromm-Rudnus norm. And y is a permutation of x minus a translation. All permutations are allowed, but we now face to another problem. The vertices can be labeled. We will examine this problem later. Now, no color on the vertices. This index takes value in the interval 0, 1. It is insensitive to scaling, good. It is insensitive to mirror inversion. And when the set is symmetric, the index is null. And if we add this assumption that no two points are located at the same spatial position, so yes, we have the reciprocity. If we relax this condition, we have not the reciprocity. The problem is that when the number of points will increase, we can have points closer and closer, so this index is not very safe. It is not a general definition. And if we would like to extend that to continuous distributions, it will totally fail. Now, we will try the same attempt to define a symmetry index, but for indirect symmetry, chirality. So chirality has been defined by Lord Kelvin. This is a rather intuitive definition, of course. It has been extended by several mathematicians. They said, well, we need that the space should be orientable to define chirality. In fact, this constraint can be relaxed. We do not need any orientability of the space to define chirality. But this is another topic. We don't care today. And so we define the chiral index still for a finite set of points. Here are the properties of the chiral index. On the major one is that when the index is null, we can say that the set is achiral. No more need to have distinct points. We have all properties. The index is insensitive to scaling, insensitive to isometries, and so on and so on. So, now we will try to extend this approach to continuous distributions. Things, and when you put two points at the same place, two points have the same coordinates, what does it mean? You put a weight on the point. This weight can be integer, but it can be anything you like. So in fact, the good model to treat that is to consider distributions. Then, discrete distributions, and further, any kind of distribution. Now I come back to the problem of labels. Here are two cubes. If I see only the vertices, only the geometry, all these two cubes are perfectly symmetry, many elements of symmetry, okay. But if I label the vertices with colors, the things are different. The cube A have not symmetry at all. This should be introduced in our model. However, the cube B exhibits a C2 rotation axis. It's symmetric, but both these cubes are chiral, indirect symmetry. We do need a mechanism to say what means color the point. So, to present that, I will do it outside the context of symmetry. Generally, how to label vertices, it can be done in a general situation. So, we will use the Wasserstein metric. The Wasserstein metric is a distance between probability laws, which was introduced in the 17th, and which has received many applications, particularly in the transportation problem. So it is well known. Here is the expression of the Wasserstein distance in the L2 case. There are other generalizations. So it is the infinum on all joint distribution for the random vector x and the random vector y of the expectation of these product here. When the two probability laws correspond to discrete and finite distributions with n equiprobable values, in other words, you can think to a sample, we get this expression. We recognize a standard linear program. The set of the joint distributions is convex, closed, and bounded, and the lower bound is rich for one or several joint distributions expressed as P divided by N, where P is a permutation matrix. For a fixed permutation, each point is bijectively associated to a point in the other set. This is the correspondence we need to exhibit. And so, we can express our distance between the two probability laws as long as there are no colors, there are factorial n possible permutations, and we calculate the sum of the n squared distance between the pair of points, and we look for the correspondence, in fact the permutation, which minimizes this sum. So, this is known since long in other fields under two names. Descriptive statisticians use this method. It is known as the Procrust method. For the Procrust method, under three correspondences, all correspondences are possible. It is known also in chemistry and bioinformatics as the RMS method, root mean square method. We have two groups of points. We calculate the square of the distance of all the n pairs. We have to minimize this sum. It is well known. Okay. So, both the Procrust and the RMS method are just instances of the Wasserstein distance. And in fact, it is a Procrust distance, and for the RMS, nobody writes that the RMS, in fact, is in a distance, but it is exactly the same. Okay, for a fixed correspondence, it appeared in most fields of literature. It was discovered and rediscovered and rediscovered. It is well known. Now, how to fix the correspondence in the discrete case and then for continuous distribution? Does anybody heard about mixture of distributions? For example, you have populations of animals, males and females. Say we measure the weights. We have a normal law for the males with some mean and another normal law for the females with another mean. Then we consider the full distribution So it is a mixture of two distributions. This is very usual. This can be presented a different way. Two space, the d-dimensional Euclidean space on the space of color. The idea is, in the space of color, we have some distribution of probability. We get a color. Once we get a color, we get a distribution in the Euclidean space. That is the main idea. It is just a more complicated presentation of a mixture of distributions. Now, I consider two such distributions. So, nothing new until here. We have just the product of the joint distribution between these color mixtures, which has a color mixture, two components. A component is a space of color and an Euclidean component. No difficulty. And here is the main assumption to understand the model. The marginal random variables in the space of colors from the first color mixture is almost surely equal to the marginal in the space of colors for the other color mixtures. What does it mean? When I pick a color for the first the first distribution, I pick the same color for the other one. This is the method to link. A consequence of that, in the Euclidean space part, the two random variables, the marginal, I mean, in the Euclidean space, cannot be independent in general. So, we extend the Wasserstein distance to this kind of probability law, this kind of random variable, which I recall you as two parts, the Euclidean part and the part in the space of color. So, we need that this set must not be empty. Fortunately, it is true. So we can compute an infimum, and we have now the mechanism which permits to put colors everywhere and to link the points. When there is only one color in the space of color, we retrieve the ordinary case, no color at all. Well, this is an example. I do not detail the calculation. Two Bernoulli laws. Same distribution, but two colors in the space of colors. And for the Bernoulli law, probability of 0 is 0.5, and probability of 1 is 0.5. This is the simplest situation. But we put, for example, the color green on the 0, and the color red on the 1, for example. Same for the other Bernoulli law. I skip the calculation. Conclusion. The two Bernoulli laws in the Euclidean space are no more independent. They are fully correlated. Only one possible joint distribution. This is the simplest example I have found to illustrate my purpose. So, in general, when we have only one color, we retrieve the ordinary Wasserstein distance. A way to see what it corresponds. Physicists often consider indiscernible particles. This is what I mean by no color, or all the colors are the same. You cannot have a distinction. And conversely, when each point resizes its own color, it's something like model with discernible particles. It may help to see the mechanism. Okay, so we can set a bijection between the two set of points. They are pairwise associated. The cardinality may be what you like. No problem. When in the case of samples, so only one joint distribution, so only one permutation matrix, and we rediscover the Procrust method and the RMS method with fixed correspondence. So the Procrust distance is just an instance of the color Wasserstein distance. For two color samples of size n, we can have subset of points having the same colors. So we just have a partition on the number of permutations is of course this one. Okay, now we have a mechanism to associate points of the same color between two sets. Now we will return back to our symmetry problem. So the chiral index in its more general form is the normalized color Wasserstein distance. We have to take the infinum or on all joint distributions, but also for all rotations and translation. For example, you have two mirror images to know if they are identical or not. You take the image and you try to superpose it of the initial object to see if it is the same. That's why we need to minimize for all rotation and translation. So this index, which generalizes the one in the discrete case, are all desired properties. Insensitivity to isometries and scaling. The reciprocity when is ensured. When the index is null, we can say that the set or the distribution is achiral. And another property, so this index is between 0 and 1, and when it takes the value 1, it implies that the covariance matrix, or the inertia matrix, as you like, is proportional to the identity matrix. I think that all regular polytops should satisfy to this constraint. It is true for the Platonic solids, but I think it's much more general. It was told me that there is a theorem for that. The optimal rotation, so the optimal translation is obvious to compute. Just set the two means to zero, no problem. The optimal rotation is known for the two-dimensional and the three-dimensional case. The unidimensional, you have no rotation at all, of course. This joint distribution, this optimal joint distribution exists. It is known in the unidimensional case, and it is the solution of the Monge-Kantorovich transportation problem for a quadratic cost. So you can find it in the many books which were written on the topic. For the discernible particles model, the chiral index is proportional to the square to the smallest eigenvalue sigma d squared of the variance matrix. And when the index, the chiral index is 1, its maximal value, it implies that the variance matrix is proportional to the identity. This is, for example, the case of the cube for which the 8 vertices have 8 different colors. It is an example of set which reaches the maximal chirality in the sense of this index, of course. So, as I said, you many people develop theories develop their own chiral index, symmetry index, and so on and so on. I said to them, well, if the theory works, it should work in the simplest case you can imagine. So I imagine that the simplest possible case have 3 points of the real line. You have only one parameter, the ratio of the length. And so the chiral index take this expression, but I say that these properties must be satisfied. The chiral index must depend only of the ratio of the length. It should be null if and only if the set is symmetric, which should say achiral because we are in the unidimensional case. It should be a continuous function on the from the scaling invariance key the ratio of the length is the same as key of the inverse of the ratio of the length. Until now, I didn't find any chiral index in the literature which satisfied to this for properties. Okay, so a few examples. Do not consider the interior of the triangles, just 3 tuple of points. We can calculate extremal figures, so they are here. Same thing for the direct symmetry index. So here are some extremal dissymmetric three tuples. Both these 5 triangles have a common geometric properties, which is expressed here. I skip because I think I am a bit late. The theory can be extended to graphs. We have points in the space, but these points can be linked with edges. So we have a graph which is realized in, for example, the three-dimensional space. So the theory still works, and the permutations are just, in fact, the automorphism of the graph, permitted by the color on the nodes, the color of the edges, maybe weights on the node, weights on the edges, directed edges, what you like. No problem. We just count the number of automorphisms and we perform the minimization. This is used, in fact, as a model for molecules because a molecule, for example, the water molecule has 3 nodes and 2 edges. So it is a general model. We have a theorem. We would like that similar objects imply closed chiral index. Okay. We have that. Particularly interesting is the case when there is no color. The consequence is that the chiral index of the sample converges to the chiral index of the parent population. So we have an estimator of the chiral index of the, we can define an estimator of the chiral index of the parent population. Okay, statisticians during years have tried to find an asymmetry coefficient, but we have an asymmetry coefficient. The oldest one is probably the skewness of Karl-Pitson, but when the skewness is null, it doesn't imply that the distribution is symmetric. But for the chiral index, if the chiral index is null, it implies that the distribution is symmetric. Furthermore, we do not need the existence of the third order moment. Only the two order moments suffice. Here are two other expressions. If you look closer, you have a series of embedded segments. If all the midpoints coincide, then the set is symmetric. It is obvious. Okay? Open problem. Build symmetry test for some class of parent distribution because we want to have an expression so that we can find that on usual tables. Of course, the theoretical expression is not general. So, other problem. What are the maximal chirality distributions in the case when there is no color? When there is color, we know all points are colored with different colors. But when there is no color at all, what are the most chiral distributions? We have the reply in the unidimensional case. In this case, the chiral index is 1 plus the infinum of the correlation coefficient of the correlation coefficient taken for all zone distribution. It cannot exceed 0.5, and it is reached asymptotically for a Bernoulli law such that the probability of 0 tend to 0, for example. In two dimensions, we have got an interval. We know that the chiral index, the upper bound of the chiral index is between 1 minus 1 divided by p and 1 minus 1 divided by 2p. We have a set which is a big O-quad. I have no time to develop it. We conjecture that this bound is optimal. Very quickly. Start with a regular polygon. Origin at the center of mass. The product, all mass are equal. The product of the mass by the square distance to the center is constant for all the vertices. Now, change the mass. Increase it, decrease the distance, but conserve the product. This is the first parameter. You have to decrease that. Then you increase the number of points. You have two parameters. When these two parameters tend to infinite, you have a sort of spiral which collapses very quickly on the center and it defines the maximal chirality set that we conjecture to be really the maximal one. Note the very simple expressions of your chiral index of which we are looking to the upper bound. Here, no bar on the Z. If not, it would be trivial. But these two maximum are not easy to compute. Exhibiting the optimal distribution is not so easy. Somebody has any idea, he is welcome to tell me. Solution for D equal 3 and above. So this is we have to use quaternion to find the optimal rotation. It is easier. Do not use rotation matrix in optimization problems. It's too complicated. So the rotation is null. In higher dimension, we do not know what is the optimal rotation. If somebody has an idea, he is welcome to tell me. Some other open problems. Is this condition necessary to have maximal chirality distribution, asymptotically or not? Variance matrix proportional to identity. Can the upper bound of the chiral index be reached or not? Having a chiral distribution, can we define its associated closest chiral distribution? We need here to find the definition before computing anything. And for translational symmetry, the model fails if we consider random vectors. I think that maybe a track for that should be to consider random functions, process, and so on. Well, so on this is a bibliography. I hope to be not too late. Sorry? To compute? There is a software which is named QCM, which works on molecular graphs. So you have a three-dimensional set plus a graph. You read that, you compute all graph automorphisms. This is the lengthy part of the algorithm, of course, and you perform the minimization problem, knowing that the optimal translation is known and the optimal rotation is known. There is no difficulty. In the general situation, or if you have too much automorphism, for example, you have 20 points, all factorial 20 permutations are authorized, you will not solve that. There is too much calculation to do. So there is a problem to compute that in some situation. But for molecules, most time it suffices because you remove hydrogen, which have no much importance, and the number of automorphisms is not so high for most molecules. It works very well. If your data does not come from chemistry, you convert it in a chemical format file, which is described in the literature, and you can use the software.
I have to turn off all that, maybe.
Who is a Dell expert? Do we have a Dell expert?
On.
This, I guess. This should be. This is new. Yeah.